Today on Maine Calling, what happens when harmful algae grows out of control? When flowers bloom, they usually look beautiful and smell good. Not the case with algae. Harmful algal blooms can take over a body of water, covering it with bright green scum and a strong odor. Why does this happen, and what problems does it cause? I'm Cindy Hahn, and today we'll learn how certain conditions can lead to an explosion of algae in Maine's lakes and ponds. And along the coast, algae is also the culprit for the red tide that endangers shellfish. Some algal blooms are toxic enough to threaten the health of humans and animals. And to add to that, when Maine's famously clear lakes turn murky and stinky, it affects tourism and housing values. What can be done about these troubling algal blooms? Maine Calling is coming right up.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to island and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Maine's lakes are famous for being pristine and clear, but sometimes they're not so picture perfect. Warmer temperatures and runoff can cause harmful algae to take over lakes and ponds, creating what's known as an algal bloom. Today we'll learn more about this phenomenon and why it can be harmful and what to do about it. My guests are Linda Bacon, lake biologist with the Maine Department of Environmental Protection, Lydie Robbins, executive director of the 30 Mile River Watershed Association, and Tristan Tabor, water quality program director, technical director, and aquatic scientist with Lake Stewards of Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you ever seen an algae-filled lake near you? Are you worried about how algal blooms might affect you or your kids or your pet? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can post a comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Linda, let's start with a basic idea about what algae is. It's something that I think people recognize but don't really know what it's, what, you know, what you call it. It's not really a plant, right?
Well, it is a photosynthetic organism. So it does take sunlight and convert it to energy. It can range from like a single cell organism to multi-cell organisms. They occur in lakes, rivers, streams, the ocean, even in puddles. They can be as big as kelp, rockweed that you see in the ocean, to the slime that you see on rocks in any of the freshwater environments.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I mean, we see it everywhere. It's not all bad, right? Can it actually be beneficial? What does it do that's helpful?
Oh, algae are at the base of the food chain or base of the food web, if you're, depending on how you look at it. Without algae, you wouldn't be able to, the smaller organisms that eat the algae would starve to death. So there's a range of algae. Some can become a nuisance. Even a subset of those can produce toxins. And I think we're going to get into that in this.
Yeah, in fact, I'll turn to Tristan to get to that because we are talking about this. The term is harmful algal bloom, and that's when certain kinds of algae just runs amok. So talk about what's happening there. How does that happen?
Yeah, so generally what we're most concerned with in the freshwater systems with an algae bloom is an overabundance of a specific population or a couple of different species. And this is usually most related to a high amount of nutrients that have come into the water body. And also in the ones that we are looking at a lot more here in Maine is the warming temperatures. There are algae blooms that can occur through ice and, you know, in very cold conditions, but the ones that we have really been focusing on and have a lot more, you know, sort of data that we're looking at tend to be the hot temperature ones.
And as you said, it's not just any algae that'll just grow like that and take over a lake. There are just certain types, and we hear about this cyanobacteria. Can you talk about what that is and what role that plays?
Yeah, so one of the biggest aspects to the algae blooms that we're really concerned with is and why they can take over is due to sort of size ratios. So they can take in a lot of nutrients very quickly. So if there is any sort of abundance of it, they can sort of outcompete and get out of control. This is, maybe for some of the listeners, we see this in other ecosystems with like too many deer because there's no longer wolves that are eating them down. And so there can be different factors that cause that, but in a lot of cases, it is the nutrients that really a lot of this comes back to. And then for cyanobacteria, that some other people might recognize that as blue-green algae, they are a specific group, and those are single-celled organisms that have sort of been around for a long, long time. But they'll form chains or groups in certain cases. Some of them are free-floating. And here in Maine, I think our concern has largely been focused on the scums because they seem to be where the ones that produce toxins are really abundant in that.
Yeah, so that's what, Lydie, I wanted to turn to you about this, the toxic conditions in the lake, because your work, you can tell us a little bit about what your group does, but you focus on ways to deal with these algal blooms because they're actually dangerous to people, right?
Yeah, so we're a nonprofit organization, and we have about 20 lakes and ponds that we work to keep clean and healthy. And so we're monitoring water quality, and then we're also doing work, on the ground to protect water quality. So we're doing projects to prevent erosion. One of the big things that we focus on is erosion from roads. The gravel from roads and driveways is one of the biggest sources of phosphorus, which feeds the algae. So we're working with towns, with road associations to try to address issues of erosion on roads. It's been especially challenging over the last few years as we've been seeing more severe storms that will overtop culverts and roads can wash out, and you're getting tons of sediment containing phosphorus that gets dumped into streams that feed into lakes, or maybe sometimes even goes directly into the lakes. And so all this phosphorus is one of the nutrients that's feeding algae. So we're working to try to reduce that, which is it's a big challenge, replacing culverts and building more resilient infrastructure in towns is costly. And the towns that we work with are very rural, so they don't have a lot of resources. So we look to find resources else and throughout the state. There are various grant programs that can help with that. So that's one of the ways. And then, of course, individual landowners can have an impact by taking care of their property and preventing erosion, preventing the nutrients from getting into lakes. So taking care of their driveways to make sure things aren't running off, making sure they have a nice, healthy vegetative buffer along the shoreline with plants that will help to slow the flow and reduce the impact of rainfall and filter out nutrients. So there are lots of things that people can do individually and at a road association or town level, or in the case with state roads, at the state level to reduce the inputs that are feeding algae.
Okay, so Linda, it sounds like there are different causes for these algal blooms. One is the warming climate, which is something maybe we can't do quite as much directly about, but like Lydie was saying, there's also this phosphorus that just feeds the algae and it just thrives when that comes in, and that's something you can do more about, right? Or what other causes are there and what can people do?
Those are the two biggest ones, temperature and nutrient availability. It's kind of like your tomatoes. If you put fertilizer on your tomatoes, you're going to get a bigger plant, you're going to get more tomatoes. Similar sort of situation with algae. There's nutrients available, then they are going to grow in the populations are going to be in proportion to the amount of nutrients available. Blue greens or cyanobacteria have an advantage over some of the others, or at least about half the species do. They can actually fix nitrogen from the atmosphere. There's atmospheric nitrogen mixed in with the water, and we have to put nitrogen on our plants or on the soil around our plants to fertilize them, unless they're nitrogen fixes. Well, there are actually algae that are nitrogen fixes. So nitrogen, if they can get their own nitrogen from the atmosphere, that gives them a competitive edge. And the blue greens, or a subset of the blue greens, are the only type of algae that can actually do that. But it is all kind of regulated by this temperature ceiling. When water temperatures don't get over, like, I'd say 60 degrees Fahrenheit, the algae populations remain fairly low. But when you get water temperatures up into the 80 degrees, like we've had over the last 10 years or so, those populations, if there's plenty of nutrients available, they just take right off.
So is
And
that, go ahead, go ahead.
a subset of those algae can produce the toxins. Very often, the toxins are produced toward the end of an algal bloom when the scums are forming near shore. And by scums, I mean something that looks like almost somebody dumped paint into the water. Those cells are beginning to die and break apart, and they release the toxins into the water column, and they end up getting concentrated because the wind has blown them into the shoreline. That's where one has to really be concerned and avoid that sort of situation.
Right, so that description of looking like paint or being this kind of pea green color that is very intense is what differentiates it from just a regular algae. When you have a bloom, it looks vibrant, right? Yeah.
Yes.
And I was going to ask, because you said it was maybe 10 years ago that the temperatures started being more consistently warm. Is that about how long we've been seeing algal blooms in Maine?
I think it's been gradually ramping up the temperature, that is. It's really been noticeable over the last 10 or 15 years as manifested in algae. But we've had algal blooms in very polluted lakes for decades. For example, Sebasticook Lake was well known nationally as like one of the most polluted lakes in the country back in the 1960s because it had municipal discharges, industrial discharges going into it, and it just was pea soup year round. The phosphorus concentrations were just they were so high they were difficult to measure accurately.
Oh, wow. So we'll talk a little bit more about what else you're seeing across the state, but I wanted to go now because calling in is my colleague, Maine Public Climate Reporter Peter McGuire. Hi, Pete. Thanks for giving us a call.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
So I know as part of your climate reporting, you have been covering this issue of algal blooms and why they're happening. What has stood out to you about what's going on?
Yeah, I think Linda just touched on it, but it's just the how much warmer Maine lakes are now. They're warming faster than the air, they're warming faster than the Gulf of Maine. And I think that's really driving a lot of these problems. And you have a great panel, and they can talk a little bit more about this. But there's also this issue of warming water and how it can release phosphorus from the sediment in the base of, like, the bottom of the lake, which is kind of a new and troublesome source of pollution for our waters.
Right, that sort of triggering effect, huh? Yeah, well, we will talk more about that, but I know that you've also observed in as you go around the state that these algal blooms can impact a community beyond just what it's doing environmentally. Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing there?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that people in Maine and visitors who come here have a really powerful emotional connection to our lakes. It's just in a lot of parts of the state. I mean, it's where kids go to swim. It's where people go to relax after they have work or on the weekend. It's where families have had camps for years and years and years. And to come and see maybe in August when you expect to be relaxing by the water and enjoying fresh pool water, it turned into this kind of like gross pea green stuff. I think that's really, That's really emotionally devastating, number one. And also, I mean, Maine's lakes are a huge economic driver. And if you don't have that kind of resource out there to, that people are willing to come and spend money and enjoy, I think that really harms a lot of communities. And some of these are rural communities where, you know, if the lake is a big economic driver.
No, Tristan, you're nodding. That's what you're seeing.
Yeah, I think Peter really touches on something that's been so critical for us. So for those people who don't know, I work for Lake Stewards of Maine. It's a statewide nonprofit, and we basically are training volunteers to go out there and observe what's happening on their local lake. So there's a lot of ownership and participation in it. And it's really heartbreaking. Every year or two, somebody who contacts myself or Linda at the DEP or something like that, and because their lake has turned, pea soup green or has these sort of weird sort of paint spills sort of look to them, and they're concerned about it. And I think that, you know, if there's any silver lining to it, it's that it can be a real galvanizing force for a community. We've had a lot of really good sort of organizations develop locally for lake associations that have sort of come together around this. And it's a lot of work and it's hard and expensive, but to try and sort of beat back this sort of long legacy phosphorus. But it's sort of brought some communities together. So that's really nice. But as Peter said, you know, it's an emotional toll to lose these beautiful, pristine places.
Yeah. And Pete, I know that the issue is getting attention at other levels. Apparently, Senator Susan Collins is trying to get federal funding to help some parts of Maine deal with this harmful algae. What do you know about that?
Yeah, I mean, this just came out about a week ago. We got a press release from Senator Collins' office, and I guess she's looking for $4 million about to do remediation in North Pond, and that's in Smithfield, kind of near the Belgrade Lakes, and Unity Ponds in Waldo County. And so, you know, I'm not sure exactly where that stands right now. That was supposed to go into the Interior Department funding. But I do think that it's notable that that's the amount of money we're talking about to remediate an algal bloom, like consistent algal bloom problems when they set in. And so that's the kind of funding hurdle that communities and the states and nonprofits need to be looking at.
Well, thanks for joining us, Pete. That's good to hear your perspective. Pete McGuire is Maine Public's climate reporter. And Lighty, I know that you mentioned, you know, the amount of resources it's taking for what you're doing in your organization. I'm just trying to figure out what do they go towards. If you're trying to stop phosphorus from getting into the lakes to stop this from happening, what do you use the resources for?
So we're not, the lakes in our area, we're not doing any sort of treatments to try to remediate algal blooms. You know, at this point, we have one lake that has been having algal blooms over the last several years. That's Androscoggin Lake. Mm-hmm. But so we're not in the work where we're raising millions of dollars to do that. You know, and Linda can talk a little bit about the alum treatment that they're planning for North Pond and alum treatments that have been used on other lakes. But what we're trying to do is we're focusing a lot on prevention. So we're in the lakes that aren't having algal blooms, we're trying to protect that water quality by keeping the phosphorus out in the first place. So as far as where those resources are going, we're raising money to replace culverts so the roads won't wash out. As I spoke about earlier, that's just, you know, one example.
Okay, great. And I know we have so much more to learn about this, but we do need to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about algal blooms. Our phone number is 800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. If you've been in and around Maine's lakes and ponds in the summertime, you may have seen the water look unusually murky and green. We're learning about the algae that causes that and when to stay clear of it. Joining me, Lydie Robbins. She's with the 30 Mile River Watershed Association. Tristan Tabor is with Lake Stewards of Maine, and Linda Bacon with Maine's Department of Environmental Protection. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you live in a community near a lake or pond? Have you noticed any changes in the water? Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And Linda, I know we were in the middle of talking about what's going on when the lakes do develop these blooms, and you are the one to talk about diagnosing what happens and what to do about it.
So Tristan mentioned that there's nothing better than an algal bloom or an invasive plant for that matter to unite people that live around the lake to actually take action. Well, generally the action includes going to the state looking for funds to be able to do the research to determine where the phosphorus is coming from, where the nutrient that is most responsible for the blooms is coming from. Generally, watershed surveys are done, so the land surrounding the lake where rainfall falls onto and runs off into the lake and carries stuff with it into the lake. You have to identify which areas in the watershed are actively eroding, and you want to correct those issues by either replacing culverts, armoring culverts, planting buffers. There's a whole plethora of solutions for taking care of eroding areas. You also have to look at the lake itself to see if there's phosphorus coming off the sediments. When the dissolved oxygen is depleted in the bottom of a lake, just student algae raining down, dying and raining down into the lake and being decomposed, those decomposing organisms use up the oxygen. When there's no oxygen, the phosphorus that is loosely bound to iron ends up having a weakened bond such that the iron can get into the water column as well as the phosphorus. And that phosphorus, just due to diffusion, can end up in the upper waters where the sunlight is penetrating, and it can fuel algal growth. They call that internal recycling of phosphorus. So in-depth sampling has to be done to quantify exactly how much phosphorus is coming off the sediments. If there's a lot of phosphorus coming off the sediments, like 40% of the phosphorus in the lake is coming off the sediment, then the organization may consider doing an alum treatment. An alum treatment ends up applying aluminum. There's the whole science to figuring out how much and the proportions, so you're not killing off anything else. But instead of making a loose bond with phosphorus, aluminum makes a permanent bond. So it basically ties it up and settles it down into the sediment so that it's no longer available to the algae. It's
so does the state
long-term solution.
Does the state go around if somebody needs an alum treatment? Is that part of your role?
Well, part of our role in my section is to evaluate the data that's collected, determine whether or not a treatment is needed. However, most of the treatments that have happened up till now have either been funded privately by fundraising by the local lake association and those around the lake. Sometimes there's been some Section 319 money used to help pay for an alum treatment. And actually, Representative Bill Briggio put through legislation a couple of years ago that ended up resulting in $200,000 that's going to go toward the Togus Pond Part 2 alum treatment. This year, he managed to get $50,000 through. I think I'm not 100% sure it's gotten through appropriations, and that's going into the Lake Restoration and Protection Fund. That's really a drop in the bucket for doing an alum treatment. So it may end up being used for evaluation of phosphorus coming off sediments. But it does take multiple approaches to to fix a problem.
We'll pick up on that a little later. We're going to switch gears for a moment, because on the line with us now is John McFedrin. He's a biologist with the Invasive Aquatic Species Program at the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. Thanks for joining us, John.
You're welcome, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And we have been focusing on algal blooms so far, but there is another threat to lakes that's in the news right now. So I wanted to make sure we touched upon that. Tell us about this invasive plant called swollen bladderwort and the trouble that it's causing.
We have 9 bladderwort species that are native to our waters in Maine. We have this one called swollen bladderwort that we listed as an invasive aquatic plant in 2023, and it has shown up in a number of different waters recently. We also know that it had been in a lake in central Maine at least for about 20, 25 years, because we saw an infestation there years ago that had a peak and then apparently has waned. The plants are still there, but not to the extent they were. But we have had significant growth of this particular plant in some water bodies of late.
And so the problem with them is they just kind of take over a lake, they clog it up?
They can grow very densely and outcompete other plants. They can also, we also have some information of dense infestations of plants having impacts on things like property values along water bodies. That was in Lake Arrowhead in southern Maine. But they can grow very densely and certainly be a difficult problem for recreation. We know people who have been spending a lot of time manually removing these plants, and we are working with some colleagues down in southern Maine and also in Massachusetts looking to see what is the best bet for trying to manage this plant. But more broadly, what we really focus on in the program is the prevention of these plants getting here in the first place, because once they are here, it is very difficult to manage them. Prevention is key. And then having people who can identify the plants is very important. Tristan is on the phone today. And of course, his organization, Lake Stewards of Maine, they also provide training on identification of aquatic plants, which is critical because we need to have those people who know what it looks like to identify it and have them identify it early in the growth pattern so that we have an opportunity for meaningful management.
Yeah, we actually heard from a botanist in Brunswick, Lorraine, who reached out to Maine Public because she was worried that all the news stories about swollen bladderwort didn't distinguish it from the native bladderwort that is not harmful and shouldn't be removed. So if someone is looking to remove the invasive species, can you at least describe what characteristics, what it looks like?
As I said, there are 9 species of bladderworts alone in the state, but there are 2 that look quite similar. The swollen bladderwort, and then its, if you will, smaller cousin, the native floating bladderwort. Each of them has a unique feature, which it has a raft. Literally, it looks like a little floating portion of the plant from which the plant flower grows. And the determination between the native and the invasive really depends on the length of the flower, the length of the portions of this raft. Then you look at the material, the vegetative material that's growing beneath the surface. And once you get a look for that, it's pretty clear whether you have the native or the invasive. On our website, if you go to Maine DEP Invasive Aquatic Plants and click and get to swollen bladderwort, there is an image showing the vegetative material for each species. But if anybody has any questions about one of their plants, they can contact us at the Department of Environmental Protection. If you go to our website, you will see an opportunity to submit a picture or a plant for identification. And again, Lake Stewards of Maine is also knows how to do this and is available for this identification.
Well, great. And that raft you're describing, I've seen the pictures, it looks like a pinwheel, kind of. That's what's very distinctive, right?
Thank you. That is a good description of that, yes.
Okay. Well, so interesting. And thanks so much for calling, John. John McFedrin is an expert in invasive aquatic species with Maine DEP. And Tristan, he mentioned that you also are working on that. So what's the precaution people can take to make sure that they're not spreading more of this invasive swollen bladder wart?
Yeah, I mean, I think the DEP and the staff here at Lake Stewards of Maine and our community have really embraced the mantra of clean, drain, dry. And that goes back to these ideas of stopping the spread. Again, John mentioned it, but it's much more expensive, much more difficult to remove something than it is to prevent it from traveling around. And so clean, drain, dry boats, and make sure that you are not transporting things. So that also applies to, you know, like if you've got bait, stuff like that, that you're not carrying any plant fat fragments in it and things like that. But boat ballast and stuff that might be on like the bunks is really a major potential source and, you know, left on motors.
Okay, then that's for a lot of invasives, actually, right? So
yep.
Good principle.
Yeah, that's for all of them.
right. Okay, well, thank you, John. And let's go to Torbert, who's calling in from York. Hi, Torbert. Go ahead.
Good morning, Cindy and guests. Here in the Seacoast, we have three main sources of pollution from excess nutrients. One is lawn fertilization done irresponsibly, both professionally and by the homeowner. Second is pet waste that irresponsible owners don't pick up after their pets. And the third is improperly sited and maintained septic systems. And there are two reasons for that. One is natural, that Maine has just got very poor soils for septic. But the second is political. And the go-no-go decision about whether a septic system is suitable is made by a site evaluator who is licensed by the Human Services Department, Health Engineering, where it should be located in the DEP. And they only get paid a few hundred dollars for siting a septic system on a lot, and that is a go-no-go for as much as a $1 million house. You might imagine the temptation and corruption is possible and maybe evident between a few hundred dollars and $1 million. And we ought to have a public service personnel in charge of that site evaluation. They would be salaried and not subject to the temptations of the marketplace. It should be located in DEP.
Right. Well, thank you, Torbert, for your comments about that. I know you know a lot about this subject. Let's go, though. We have on the line now Cheryl St. Peter, project manager with Friends of Cross Lake. Thanks for calling, Cheryl.
Thank you.
Tell us where Cross Lake is and where do you and your husband live in relation to the lake?
Okay, we live on the lake, and Cross Lake is pretty much halfway between Caribou and Fort Kent. We're like 20 miles from the border with Canada, the northernmost border at Fort Kent. And we've lived here for 21 years now.
And what problems are you seeing with these algal blooms there?
Well, Cross Lake has historically had almost annual lakewide algal blooms since the 1950s, but the last one we had that was lakewide was October of 2020. And in fact, if you look at the Google Earth image, historical one from October 11th, 2020, it shows how green Cross Lake was at the time compared to the nearby lakes. It's hard to tell it from different from the trees all around us. Since then, we've had smaller ephemeral blooms that don't last and are not lake-wide, but nothing like that. And there's reasons for that.
And that's that you all are getting quite involved, right? I mean, first of all, how is this impacting you as a resident right there? And what are you doing about it?
Well, what we've been doing is in 2018, there were about 35 concerned local people who got together and started Friends of Cross Lake. My husband and I were the impetus for it, and we were looking to try to find solutions to our water quality problem at the time and to apply for grants. And the Maine DEP has been amazing. There was a Kathy Hoppe who was working up here at the time. She's retired, and now Kirsten Thompson is helping us. And then Lake Stewards of Maine and Maine Lakes have both statewide organizations have been wonderful in helping us. Kristen comes up and does a water quality monitoring training every year. And Linda came up this year, Linda Bacon. We also worked with the Aroostook County, the Town of Fort Kent, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and the Soil and Water Conservation District. So we've done quite a bit of work in 7 years. We started with a watershed survey in 2019 looking for soil erosion sites. They're also called non-point source sites. And that's, you've talked about soil erosion. I know both Lighty and other, Tristan and Linda talked about that. We then completed a watershed-based management plan, which is a plan, a 10-year plan to see what you can do where you're problems are, and we had a wonderful consultant work with us on that, and that was with through a grant. And now we're on our second phase of implementation grants. I know Linda mentioned 319 grants, and they're to help prevent soil erosion in the watershed from bringing that excess phosphorus into the lake. And our work has also included outreach and education and lake smart evaluations.
Oh, great. We're going to talk a little bit about Lake Smart in a bit, but I just wanted to know, Cheryl, that I'm sure this is challenging because your region has a lot of farming going on. So how do you work with the farmers when that's contributing to the runoff?
Yeah, actually, that was one of our initial challenges. And initially, the farmers had some misinformation and skepticism about focal and what we were trying to do and our goals. But since then, first of all, the Soil and Water Conservation District has been wonderful helping us with the second phase of our grant and putting out more and more accurate information and outreach. And the NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service in Fort Kent, is great because they have lots of communication with the farmers, and they're also working with us to help tell them we are really just trying to provide funding for conservation practices that they may want to do that will also protect water quality. So it really benefits both. Our 319 funding for agriculture conservation practices are things that they may want to do, or but the additional funding for that helps them do it and see that it's beneficial to keep the soil on their farmland and out of our lake.
Well, really stepped up there, Cheryl. It's a win-win situation you're trying to present to them. That's great. Well, thank you for calling and sharing what you're doing at Cross Lake. Cheryl St. Peter is with Friends of Cross Lake in Aroostook County. And we do need to go to another quick break. We will be right back. This is Maine Calling. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Some algae is good for Maine waters, but not when it grows out of control. We're learning about ways to deal with harmful algal blooms. With me, Tristan Tabor with Lake Stewards of Maine, Linda Bacon with Maine DEP, and Lighty Robbins with the 30 Mile River Watershed Association. Share your comments and questions. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or you can call 1-800-399-3566. And we have a caller now. This is Pat calling in from Vienna. Hi, Pat. Go ahead. Oop, can you hear me, Pat?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. My husband and I live in New Jersey, but we fortunately get to summer in Maine on a lake, and we have identified the need to volunteer and help protect our lake. My husband does boat inspections at our public boat launch, checking boats and trailers for plants both coming into the lake and coming out. And I volunteer with a group who survey our lake, every single part of it, looking for invasive plants every year. And I just feel that we are so fortunate to be in the state of Maine where this is such an important activity. In New Jersey, unfortunately, I don't believe there are any bodies of water that do not have invasive plants. So we feel very lucky to be up here and attempt to be good stewards of our lake and the environment. And I must give a shout out to Lydie. She has been tremendously helpful to both our volunteer group and to us personally with the training and what to look for. So we just feel very blessed to be here. And thank you all.
Wonderful to hear what you're doing. Thanks for calling in, Pat. Lydie, it's people like this who are really making you make a difference with what you're doing.
For sure. We in our work depend so much on volunteers. And, you know, and we work really closely with LSM to train and support volunteers, on the lakes and in our area, which I said earlier is about 20 lakes and ponds that we're doing all this work on. And so it takes lots. Just on in our area, we have about 200 volunteers that help us in various ways with plant surveys, boat inspections, lake smart surveys, water quality monitoring, and other aspects of our work. So there. And we can always use more volunteers. And there are lots of lakes in the state that don't have as many volunteers or maybe don't even have a lake association to do work there. So there are always opportunities to get involved. And I think a point that I want to make is I think for a long time in Maine, we've been able to get away with a lot. Like we've kind of taken our water quality and the lack of invasive species for granted, but it's getting harder and harder, and it really all of us have to step up and work harder to protect these lakes. Climate change is really challenging for sure, and the number of lakes in the state that are getting invasive species makes it harder. Warmer waters make it easier for invasive species to grow more abundantly. So it's challenging, but I think our lakes are still. Most of them are still really in good shape and really worth protecting. And as we've been talking about throughout this hour, it's so much cheaper to protect them than it is to try to remediate them, whether it's an invasive species infestation or an algal bloom. So it takes everybody and in all these ways that we've been talking about, you know, working to be good stewards and not taking our clean lakes for granted.
Right. And Linda, what Lydie was saying, you know, not all of the lakes are having these problems. So is there a certain number of lakes that are problem lakes as opposed to the others that you know statewide?
There are about 30 lakes that bloom routinely. But that being said, all of the lakes are at risk for algal blooms and invasives. It really comes down to an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So it's sad that it takes some event like a bloom or an infestation to rally the troops. People should be trying to keep their lake healthy from the get-go.
All right. Well, calling in now is Susan Gallo. She is the executive director of Maine Lakes. Thanks for joining us, Susan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we've just heard about some of the good work being done, and I know there are quite a few organizations in Maine focused on protecting Maine lakes like yours. What can you describe the joint efforts that are happening that are going to address these harmful algae?
Sure. Well, as you've heard, like throughout the show, people have mentioned who they're working with, and all of our lake organizations, all of our lake associations, I think we're a very collaborative group of organizations. We're always working together on all kinds of different efforts. And as you heard, there's a lot of work to be done. So we have to work together to be efficient with our limited resources. And I think that's one of the messages that I'd like listeners to take away is that we don't have enough funding to pay for all of these things. You know, Linda mentioned the $50,000 coming into the lake protection Water Quality Protection Fund. And as she said, that is a drop in the bucket. So a lot of this work, lake protection work, is organized by nonprofits and different regional organizations. The bulk of the work is done by volunteers who, like your caller, who is working on invasive plant patrols in with Leidy. But, the workload is just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger as climate change and all the different things you mentioned on the show already come to pass. So one of the things that the lake organizations are trying to do is join together, and we have created a new effort called the Lake Protection Coalition. It's an effort to bring everybody together around lakes, to advocate for lake policies, smart lake policies, and importantly for funding. Peter mentioned that Susan Collins put out a press release about funding some specific work, but that's also a drop in the bucket because the EPA proposed cuts to the EPA budget that would include big cuts to the 319 program, which is the program that does the watershed surveys, which some of your guests have mentioned that, watershed surveys are a key step to identifying sources of phosphorus pollution. So finding state and federal funding, both, retaining federal funding, we're going to have to fight really hard to keep our EPA funding strong this cycle. And so the Lake Protection Coalition is a great way to get involved. And
okay, that's really, yeah, that's great to know, Susan. I'm sorry, your audio is a little off, but it was good to hear about what's going on. So thank you. That was Susan Gallo with Maine Lakes. And I'm going to read an email here from Rob. He says, I led a team monitoring toxic algal blooms for more than a decade before I came to Maine, and would like for people to know they should not go swimming in water where blooms are observed. Certain species can produce both neurotoxins and hepatotoxins. Also, please do not let your dogs or pets swim in the water that has visible blooms. We investigated large dogs that died within hours of swimming in a toxic bloom. They often lick their fur where the deadly toxins, if present, are ingested. And actually, this was certainly something that called algal blooms to national attention when we heard news in other states of pets having died and the harm to humans. And we haven't talked much about that. So Tristan, I wanted to turn to you. First of all, has anything like that happened in Maine? And why is this toxicity? I mean, is it that bad?
Yeah, so I will just put out that in terms of specific cases, I don't know of any conclusive ones at this time that people or pets have died from. The Maine DEP algal bloom site has a lot of good information on the precautions to take around that. And as the person who emailed in said, that is a really good sort of quick summary. Linda can probably mention specifically, but with our volunteers, we always tell them, if you are going swimming, you think that there might be some sort of algae growth, make sure you're rinsing off, things like that as additional measures. But going back to, smaller children, dogs, they're going to potentially be more at risk due to sort of the body size, and it can impact anybody. So neurotoxins, obviously damage to the brain or nerve system, and hepatotoxins, damage to liver, these sorts of things. So ingestion is obviously much more significant than what can pass through our skin, but there can be dermatoxins that cause bad reactions. And maybe Linda, would you like to say something on
a quick minute left. So I was just curious whether there are advisories that go out or signs that tell people stay away from the lake.
There is no legislative authority for DEP to put signage out at this point in time. But locals, if you own a beach or you have a town beach and you have an algal bloom, you can post a sign. DEP has analyzed more than 1,000 samples. Tristan did some when he was with us. And the samples that actually come back with microcystin are the samples that were taken from the scums themselves. A lot of the open water samples are low lower than the EPA. Most of them, like 99% of them, are lower than the EPA threshold. Go visit the site for more information.
Right. And that goes for drinking water warnings as well, correct? So just if you need more, go to the Department of Environmental Protection, and there is more information there. Well, thank you all for joining us today. Linda Bacon, who you just heard, is a lake biologist with the Department of Environmental Protection. Lydie Robbins is executive director of the 30 Mile River Watershed Association. And Tristan Tabor is water quality program director and an aquatic scientist with Lake Stewards of Maine. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. And tomorrow on the program, we will find out the status of deportations in Maine. I'm Cindy Hahn. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.